Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Tonight we pick up in Exodus 10. And I think if we've come to recognize anything through this study of the plagues that befell Egypt, what we've really seen is God's hand of providence at work, God sovereignly dispensing His will on human beings, and we've seen Him providentially pour out punishment and judgment on some people whose biggest fault simply was that they hadn't been chosen. They happened to be Egyptians, and therefore they were called Pharaoh's people, not God's people. And God put a division between what He called my people and your people when speaking to Pharaoh. And so there were a lot of people who suffered the consequences of God's judgment because they hadn't been chosen. Versus the Israelites, who we can't say were necessarily faithful, God-fearing people. These are the same Israelites who are going to go out into the wilderness and just get a couple days' journey out into the wilderness. Hooray, we've been delivered. We just went through the Red Sea. They're going to make it to Mount Sinai. They're going to see the thundering clouds and the dark clouds. They know God is up there. They've heard the voice of God from heaven. Moses goes up to talk to God, and they start building a golden calf. So you can't say that these are people who are so convinced and so faithful that God said, well, these have to be my people. Look at how good they're doing. In fact, that whole concept of God looking down the telescope of time to see who the faithful are and then choosing them on the basis of their foreseen faith can't be said of Israel. All He could see of them is that they're going to be backsliding and they're going to be trouble to Him. And in fact, He's going to make them march through the wilderness for 40 years just to kill the whole first generation that came out of Egypt so that the second generation can go in. So you can't say these were good people, and yet they're going to be delivered. The language is going to be redemption. On the basis of, God is already making a separation between them. He's pouring out these judgments that are going to culminate in death, and yet He's separating out His people and not judging His people and protecting His people and keeping His people and securing His people because they're His people. And how did they become His people? He chose them. So you see God pouring out by His providential hand, by His almightiness, by His absolute sovereignty, pouring out blessings and cursings based on those He chose and those He didn't choose. So one more time, I'm just really stressing this to say, when we talk about this whole election thing, as we have been on Sunday mornings working our way through the early parts of Ephesians, and I know all of you think that by now I should be done with the first six verses, and I'm not. Sunday, there's still more to say about the theology of those first six verses. And so that theology, as we talk about it in a Pauline context, people say, well, yeah, but, you know, that's the New Testament. But if it's true that God is always the same, God never changes, if it's true, known unto God are all His ways from the beginning, if it's true that there is neither variableness, neither shadow of turning with God, as James writes, if all of that is true, then God is always the same way. The way He is now is how He's always been. If that's true, then we would see indications of that throughout the Bible. In fact, we'd see indications of that throughout history. And so when folk argue against the concept of God choosing or electing, they usually try to argue against it in a very limited sphere. They try to say, well, look at this little passage here in John, or look at these two verses out of context over here. But the whole total context of the whole Bible says God is always like this. God always acts the same way. He's completely consistent. And that consistency culminates in He chooses some people and they fall under His hand of blessing. And the people He doesn't choose fall under His hand of judgment. And it's always been that way, ever since Cain slew Abel. Right? Why did Cain slay Abel? Why was there slewing and slaying going on between Cain and Abel? It's because they both brought a sacrifice to God, and God accepted one of them or rejected the other. Seems a tad arbitrary, doesn't it? And so Cain gets angry about it and kills his brother. Why? Because God, right from the very beginning, said, okay, now all mankind is sinful, and I'm going to start separating, I'm going to start dividing. You got four people spoken of in the Bible, Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel. God's already picking and choosing, and death is already resulting because the ones who don't get chosen get so upset about the idea that the other did get chosen. It's always been that way. To this day, you can walk around and tell people God picks and chooses, and they will try to kill you for it. If not physically, at least psychologically and emotionally, and they'll yell and snarl and sniff at you because they just hate that idea. But it's the same old God working the same way all the way through the Bible. Do you understand that? And are you seeing that in the way that these plagues are playing out? Because I sure have tried to draw that out of the text here, because it's inherent in the text. It's built into the text. And we're going to see that again with the plague of locusts, starting in chapter 10. And then he's going to bring darkness and separate those people from his people. He just keeps doing this. And then, of course, there's going to be death for the firstborn. And he's going to come to his people and tell them how to avoid the death. And he's not going to tell the Egyptians. Now, that's inherently unfair. We would all argue, well, wait, if you know the death is coming, God, and if you love everybody so much, like we talked about on Sunday, then you need to tell everybody how to avoid the death. And he doesn't. Doesn't that seem incredibly unfair? Unless it is the same consistent God working the same consistent way, which is picking and choosing and saying, I choose to tell these people the way of life. And I don't choose to tell these people. And then I'm going to judge those people and kill them for not knowing the very thing I didn't tell them. And then he sends his son. And his son comes and saves some people. Is that unfair? We talk about, you know, limited atonement or Jesus dying for his particular people, and people get all upset and say, oh, no, 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 don't like that doctrine. Say, why? It's the same thing he's been doing ever since Egypt. He's always been that way. Yeah, you had your hand up.
Yeah, just a little bit of clarification.
Sure.
God is a just God. He, you know, we are all worthy of being punished. We all
right.
deserve it. But when he chooses, it is just because, you know, he can justify choosing us. But, you know, he can also justify not choosing somebody else.
Right. That's why we talk so much about grace and the importance of grace as a new covenant theological salvation concept. You can't talk about God's salvation without talking about how gracious it is of him to do it. People who think that all humans are intrinsically good, that's why they have such a struggle theologically, because they have to explain how it is that a good and loving, beneficent God could let some people go to hell. And so they'll tell you that God wants everybody to be saved, and he loves everybody equally, and everybody's good, but some people just aren't apparently good enough or smart enough or fast enough or something. They just don't make the right decision. They just don't believe enough. And so God, despite his overwhelming love for them, is forced to send them into everlasting fire and torture. Well, that's a very, very confusing theology. But if you understand the way the Bible describes it, and when we get to Ephesians 2, you're going to see it spelled out, that all of mankind is dead in their trespasses and sins, that we're all enemies of God, that we're all wicked and depraved, well, then God is under no obligation to save anybody. And everybody who goes to hell is getting exactly what they deserve. So if anybody doesn't go to hell, that's where the unfairness is. It's not unfair that God judge anybody. Everybody deserves the judgment. But if somebody misses the judgment, God in his divine unfairness, to use a great Old Testament phrase, plucked some brands out of the fire. And he did it because he was just that gracious, which is why, like we read on Sunday, that he does this to the praise of the glory of his grace. So when he's saving people, whenever you talk about God saving individuals, you have to put it in that context of God is glorifying himself and demonstrating his grace against the backdrop of an unbelievable darkness that demands judgment. So if you start with the idea that you're good, pretty good, more or less good, then you can say, God saved me because I was good enough. And then you look at somebody else and say, and he didn't save that person because they're just not as good as me. Right? They didn't do what I did. They didn't choose what I chose. They didn't study the way I studied. Whatever it was I did that they didn't do it, and it's their fault. And that is the completely upside down, backwards theology. The biblical theology says, nobody deserves it. You can't deserve it. And in fact, the more works you do and the harder you work to be good in order to get saved, the more you're saying, I can be saved by my works and I don't really need a savior. I don't really need grace. I can do it by my legal standard. And those are exactly the people that Jesus used his choicest words against to say, you're whitewashed sepulchers. You look clean on the outside, and on the inside, you're full of all dead men's bones, all uncleanness. Called them a brood of vipers. These were the people who were busy walking around trying to keep the law and be saved on the basis of doing good. And those are the ones Jesus said, you'll come to me and say, Lord, Lord, haven't we done this? Haven't we done that? And I'll say, your works are iniquity, and I never knew you. So the consistent theology is nobody's worthy. And anybody who gets saved, it's a matter of grace. And let me add to that, since you've just pushed one of those buttons in my brain that makes me expound this way, let me also add that a God who is waiting around for people to validate him, you know, he'd like to save everybody. He sent his son just in case anybody decides to get saved. But he's waiting for somebody to choose him, pick him, validate him in some way. Why would you worship such a God? Really, he seems powerless to do anything. He's waiting around going, I sure hope Josh chooses me. And then if he does, I want Josh to worship me. Why? He should be thanking Josh. Thank you for validating me. You know, I sent my son in the hope that somebody was going to choose my son, and you did, and that made my son look good, so thanks, man. Like God would ever use the phrase, thanks, man. But, you understand what I'm saying? But a God who is under no obligation whatsoever to any human being, who then invites some human beings into his presence, totally and completely pays the price for those, pours out his wrath for those on his son, and then brings them into his presence and makes them spotless and unblemished and perfected forever, you can worship that God without trying. That is a God that you will get down in front of and say, you're worthy to be praised. You're worthy of all honor and glory forever because, oh my goodness, look at me, look at you, and I'm here. How did this happen? It happened because you're really just that good. And you will not spend any time in eternity talking about how good you are. You'll be talking about how good he is and how great it was that he would save you. So when you're talking about justice, which was the language you used a couple times in your question or your comment, when you're talking about justice, hell is justice. And everybody who goes to hell, that's just. Look, the Egyptians, worshiping all those foreign gods, Pharaoh denying, you know, Yahweh completely, didn't he deserve everything he got?
But the way you stated that it could have been misinterpreted that the only reason God chose to punish them, the only reason bad things happened to them was because God chose them, but they did deserve.
Oh, absolutely. Right. And God did not choose them for goodness. He just left them in their depraved state. Absolutely. But if now that you've said that he left Egypt in their depraved state, and that's why they received his punishment, if God doesn't change, can he still do that today? Sure. The question now is, does he still do that today? Well, yeah. He still leaves a great many people in their darkness and simply doesn't enlighten them. Doesn't exude that graciousness that leads to salvation. He's always been that way, though. So when we say that, it sounds strange to people in this very contemporary American society and economy where we do our own choosing. We choose our own leaders every 4 years. We don't know what it is to have a king or a sovereign over us, and we make up our own mind, and we're a self-made man, and we wear Nikes, just do it. And that whole kind of thinking that is this generation of humans. When you say to those kind of humans, you know, God doesn't have to be good to you, that just freaks them out because they think that simply by virtue of being born, they deserve every goodness there is, which is why we are absolutely buried right now in our government in handouts and programs and everything else to make sure that nobody ever falls short of everything they think they deserve. you know, you have no guarantee just by being born that you're never going to be offended. The fact that you're here is no guarantee that you're always going to be happy and that you're not going to get hurt. Amen. And you should not have to have the right to sue people just because you got hurt. If you're drying your hair with an electric hair dryer in the shower, then really you don't deserve to sue the shower maker or the hair dryer people. In fact, it's really just thinning the herd. Every once in a while you have to do that. You're just not real bright and you need to go now. You're bringing down the average IQ. So far too often now people think that they deserve all this stuff. And we live in a society that keeps trying to give stuff to people on the basis of, well, you're here, you must deserve stuff. Well, then it's impossible to tell them that God doesn't think you deserve things. That God, in fact, thinks that his justice and his righteousness is more important than your egocentric sense of what you deserve. And he will give you your just deserts based on his righteousness and holiness and your complete lack of it. And that just shakes people up today. Just going, no, God can't be like that. But the point I'm driving over and over is, he's always been like that. The fact that we live in a generation that denies it doesn't change it. He has a long, rich history of always being like that. Right? Okay. That was all introduction.
That was good.
Tom said that was good, though. So, all right.
You did more in 10 minutes than most churches do in a whole year.
Oh, well, thank you very much. So, I'll take that. That was my Christmas gift, wasn't it? That was it. That was
done.
No online shopping for Tom. All right, let's get into this. The plague of locusts, starting in chapter 10. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that I may perform these signs of mine among them." How clear is that statement?
Pretty clear.
Does that statement say that God can completely invade the free will of an individual human in order to accomplish his ultimate goal, even if that invasion of that man's free will results in the condemnation of that man?
It says that he did.
It not only says he can, it says he did. Now, if God doesn't change, and we have an example here of him doing that very thing, does he still do that? When we read the book of Revelation, you read the Daniel prophecies. When you read the apocalyptic literature in the Bible that says that the world is going to wrap up a certain way, it talks about the little horn, who we've nicknamed Antichrist, even though that's not a proper nomenclature necessarily for that guy, but we know what we mean when we say Antichrist. We're talking about the little horn. We're talking about that final world ruler. And then people are going to follow him. And Paul writes in the Thessalonian letter that God is going to turn those people over to a strong delusion so that they will believe the lie and be damned. I mean, that's New Testament now. If that's true, people go, what? What? God's going to do what? God's going to turn people over to a strong delusion so that they will believe the lie and be condemned as a result? No, God can't do that. He's been doing it ever since Egypt. It's what he's always been like. Nothing's changed. So at the beginning of the book and the end of the book, you get a very consistent personality profile of a God who does everything according to his will, his good pleasure, in order to bring himself the greatest glory. So the Lord said to Moses, "Go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart." I also find it amusing. I'm never going to get past this verse. I understand that. But I find it very interesting that he would say, I already have determined what the outcome is. I'm going to harden his heart, and I'm going to pour out more of my plagues on him. But now go tell him. Isn't that interesting? I mean, wouldn't God, you would think, at some point say, oh, forget it, I've hardened his heart, let's just pour out the plagues, let's just get this over with. But God keeps building plague upon plague, hardship on top of hardship, culminating, like I said, in the death of all the firstborn. But God also says, I've hardened his heart, I've already done that, so that he will not listen to you. Listen to this language. I've hardened his heart and the heart of all his servants that I may perform these signs of mine among all of them. That is such a clear declaration of I've hardened his heart because that's what serves my greater glory. These works of mine must be accomplished, so that all the earth will know that I am God. And so therefore I've hardened his heart. But go tell him. And so he's going to be, I think, in many ways, extra responsible, because he can't ever say, well, you didn't tell me. And that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I made a mockery of the Egyptians. Okay, now, I get accused frequently of being sarcastic.
No.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, on Sunday, this is true. Tom will attest that this is true. We went back to the house to watch football. I don't know if you remember what I was wearing on Sunday, but I had that black shirt on, so I had chosen a black T-shirt to wear under it. And one of the black T-shirts I have is the shirt you gave me that says, sarcasm, it's just one of the services I offer. Just another service I offer, yeah. And so I had that on under the black shirt on Sunday, believe it or not, the undercurrent of everything I was talking about. And here, God himself says, I have hardened Pharaoh's heart and his servants' hearts. The first reason is so that I can perform these signs of mine. But the other reason, the auxiliary reason, is so that you may tell your son and your grandson how I made a mockery of the Egyptians. This is God saying, I want you to keep telling the story. And I want you to pass it down generation to generation. And when you tell it, I want you to say, I mocked the Egyptians.
But he
loved them. He loved them so much. That's why the last couple weeks I've been using that phrase that God was sort of poking the other gods with a stick. And people kind of go, really? What does that mean? Well, he's mocking them. It's what he's doing. In fact, flip forward to chapter 12 for a second. Sarcasm is biblical. That's what I'm saying. You know, it does say in the Psalms that when all the kings of the earth gathered together to withstand God and his son, and it says that God laughs and has them in derision. See, that's sarcasm. That's only, God laughs at them like, really, really, you're coming to work here, there, you're done. So, look at chapter 12 for a minute, and look at verse 12, so you'll understand where I'm getting this, that God is poking a stick at their gods. 12:12 says, for I will go through the land of Egypt on that night, and I'll strike down all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. So God is setting up a very clear contrast here. And saying, I'm doing all this not just to show Pharaoh who's boss, but I've hardened the hearts now of all his servants. I'm going to show them who's boss. And I'm going to pour out my judgment on all the Egyptians. I'm going to show them who's boss. When I kill the firstborn, it'll be all the firstborn of Egypt, going to show everybody who's boss. And he says, and I'm going to execute my judgment against the gods of Egypt. So God is taking this very, very personally in saying they are worshiping this whole pantheon of gods that are not gods, and so I'm pouring out my judgments against Egypt to make a mockery of the Egyptians for worshiping all these gods that simply are not gods, which ought to, in your thinking, take you all the way back to the burning bush when God identified himself as I am. I'm the one that is. All those Egyptian gods are not, but I am that I am, and now he's proving that point. I am, and in so doing, I am mocking the Egyptians for their love or following of any other god. So tell them how I made a mockery of the Egyptians and how I performed my signs among them, that you may know this thing, that I am the Lord. Now there it is one more time. God's inspiration for pouring out these terrible judgments against people who, as I began by saying, he didn't choose them. He left them in their depravity, as Sam pointed out. He leaves them in that state and then judges them in that state. But the purpose ultimately is not the damage of these people. The purpose ultimately is the glorification of God. the purpose ultimately of everything God does is his own glory. And Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said to him, "Thus says the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go, that they may serve me." Verse 4, "For if you refuse to let my people go, behold, tomorrow I will bring locusts into your territory, and they will cover the surface of the land, so that no one shall be able to see the land." Can you imagine how many locusts that is? Swarms of locusts that will darken the sky and be so thick on the ground you won't be able to see the ground, which means just walking gets crunchy. I suppose you guys were all here when we had the last cicada attack, right? Where every 14 years or something? 7 to 14, depending on where you are and which cicadas. And that's just creepy. They live in the ground for 7 years, 14 years, and then suddenly all at once, as if somebody blows a horn and goes, "Now!" they all pop up out of the ground and they all become flying crickets. And they're everywhere.
They're not nearly as bad as what this
was. Not as bad. That's my point.
Yeah.
The last cicada thing, which was what, 2-3 years ago? The last big cicada event, did you find it as irritating to go outdoors as I did?
They ate everything.
Absolutely. Bury your trees, take care of your vegetables, clean out your garden. They'll eat everything because there's so many of them.
They lost a cat.
They ate a cat? What are you saying? Wow. I found it really irritating to go outside because they're everywhere and they're buzzing around and they get on you and they're anything, sweet mom, you get in the car, they come in with you, you got to clean them out. And like you just said, that wasn't anywhere near as bad as this. You get a couple days of cicadas and it's just irritating to no end. Can you imagine locusts, especially in an economy that is an agrarian culture that is absolutely dependent on what it's growing in the fields? And then locusts come in and wipe out everything in the fields. "For if you refuse to let my people go, behold, tomorrow I will bring locusts into your territory, and they'll cover the surface of the land, so that no one shall be able to see the land. They shall also eat the rest of what has escaped, what is left to you from the hail, and they shall eat every tree that sprouts for you out of the field." So that any of the fruit hanging on any of the trees, any of the leaves that are left, anything that's growing that they could have eaten is going to be devoured by the locusts. "Then your houses shall be filled, and the houses of all your servants, and the houses of all the Egyptians, something which neither your fathers nor your grandfathers have seen from the day that they came upon the earth until this day." And he turned and he went out from Pharaoh. Now that language, by the way, anybody who was here for our Revelation study, that language should sound really familiar to you, because God has a tendency to say things like that. "I'm going to do something now that is so bad that nobody's ever seen it before. It'll be the worst thing that I've ever done up until this moment." And that's the language of the day of the Lord, the final judgment, when Christ comes back and he's going to start mopping up nations. A day of darkness, a day of trouble such as, this is Jesus' words, a day of trouble such as never was or ever will be again. But when Jesus said that, that was not unique language. You go all the way back here to Egypt and God's saying, "I'm going to do something that your fathers, your grandfathers, nobody has ever seen before since the day that there were people on the planet. I'm going to make a plague of locusts so bad that it's going to be nothing like anything you can imagine." So it'll be in your houses, verse 6, your houses will be filled, the houses of all your servants, the houses of all the Egyptians, something with which neither your fathers nor your grandfathers have seen from the day that they came upon the earth until this day. And he turned and he went out from Pharaoh. And Pharaoh's servants said to him, this is interesting, now Pharaoh's servants are starting to turn on Pharaoh and saying, you know, this keeps happening. Every time Moses comes in and says something bad's going to happen, well, it does. And so a smart man would buy a clue. And Pharaoh's servants said to him, how long will this man be a snare to us? Let the men go, that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not realize that Egypt is destroyed? So even Pharaoh's own people. Now, given that, given those circumstances, given the fact that every time Moses says it's going to happen, it happens. Now his own counselors, his own servants, the people who actually have access to Pharaoh, are telling Pharaoh, look, a smart man would give up on this thing. Let them go. Let them go worship their God. You've destroyed the whole country. Wouldn't any rational person at this point say, yeah, you're right. You make a good point. This is insane. So how are we going to explain that stubborn arrogance where even in the face of overwhelming evidence, he still just won't do the right thing? Well, it's back here in verse 1. Go to Pharaoh because I hardened his heart. It's right there. Rationality, logic, history should have made Pharaoh say, you're right, I should let these people go. But he doesn't because God has hardened his heart so that he can work his signs, so that he can mock the Egyptians. And it's all God doing what God wants to do. And so verse 8, so Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh, and he said to them, go, serve the Lord your God. Who are the ones that are going? And Moses said, we shall go with our young and our old, with our sons and our daughters, with our flocks and our herds we will go, for we must hold a feast to the Lord. Now we've got to talk about that word for a moment. That word feast there is actually a Hebrew word that means a set time. This is a time that God set aside and said, at this time, every year, you will do a particular thing. These feasts to the Lord are then set up in the yearly calendar that God is going to give the Israelites at Mount Sinai. Three times a year, every Israelite that can travel is required to go up to Jerusalem for a feast. And there is food and there is drink and there is feasting going on, but the key behind the word, the definition of the word, is not just come and eat, it's a feast, it's a party. It's a set time of God. It's an appointment that God has made for his people, and they are required to come and keep those feasts. The first of them is going to be the Passover, and he's going to establish the Passover on the 14th of Nisan, when he's going to deliver them, which is the night that the death angel comes and kills all the firstborn of Egypt. God is going to memorialize that and say, now every year at this time, come to Jerusalem, so that every year you're forced to come and remember that I did this thing. So when you see the word feast, think God purposefully setting expectations for his people and setting a time and saying, at this time every year, you'll stop what you're doing. And you'll come to Jerusalem, and you'll worship me. And he's going to set up three of those times each year. So he said to them, thus may the Lord be with you. If ever I let you and your little ones go, take heed, for evil is in your mind. Not so, go now, the men among you, and serve the Lord, for that is what you desire. So they were driven out from Pharaoh's presence. Now, it sounds like Pharaoh's pretty convinced at this point. Is he going to stick with that? Why not? Exactly. Because it's God that's going to overwhelm his will. I've had an email exchange here recently with a guy who said that in his church, there's been an ongoing argument here recently about the question of free will versus God's predestinary will and God's sovereignty, and that his pastor recently brought a book to the pulpit, and it was Chosen But Free by Norman Geisler. You familiar with this book? That is the book in which Geisler says that the Calvinistic notion of an irresistible grace where God can impose himself on particular people and cause them to respond irresistibly, he likens it to, and this is the phrase he uses, cosmic rape. Yeah. And this is Norman Geisler, big-time Christian teacher. First time I heard that phrase was when Geisler was on the Bible Answer Man. And he used that phrase. The Calvinistic approach of God's electing and irresistible grace is just a form of cosmic rape. And I thought, wow, I would hate to be in your shoes the day you got to stand in front of God and explain that phrase or how it is that you arrived at that. But here's my point. Does God have a long, rich history of imposing his will on a human being's will and overwhelming their will to the point where they're going to do what God wants them to do despite all of the evidence to the contrary, all the rational logic to the contrary? We know what Pharaoh should do right now, but he's not going to do it. And the explanation that God gives us and that Moses records for us here is that God is going to do what God's going to do, and he's going to harden Pharaoh's heart so that Pharaoh isn't going to let them go, so that God can work all his works, so that God gets all the glory. So you have an example all the way back here of God interrupting the will of man for his own cause. How much greater then is it to hear that God interrupted your will for his own cause, and that cause was to save you? To save you from yourself, save you from your sin, your depravity, to save you from the fact that you're going to hell. Like lemmings off a cliff, you are running as fast as you can toward hell, and God decided to impose his will and overwhelm your will and draw you to himself. I never heard better news. I don't think of that as any form of imposition on me. I'm really glad he did it, because I do understand that left to myself, I'm lost. But anybody who can say negative things about the irresistibility of God's gracious imposition of election and salvation on a person, that's a person who actually believes that they could do it themselves, that they were good on their own, and that if God leaves them alone, they'll choose anyway, and they'll do the good anyway, and they'll get saved anyway, that they don't need God to impose on them because they have a capability in and of themselves to do good. Boy, what deception. All right, back here. There's just so much content in here. I thought we'd get through at least the locusts and the darkness tonight, but no. So let's see, verse 12. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt for the locusts, that they may come up on the land of Egypt and eat every plant of the land, even all that the hail has left." Now that's interesting, because in the previous verse, Pharaoh ends up saying, "Not so, go now, the men that are among you, and serve the Lord, for that is what you desire." So Pharaoh asked the question, how many are going to go? And he said, young and old, women, children, herds, all of us, we're all going. Pharaoh tries to renegotiate the deal. And he says, well, all your men can go then. Let the men go, because that's what you really desire. So you men can go, but not everybody. And then God brings on the plague, because he's not doing it God's way. What does this tell you about God's reaction to people who know his word, hear his word, but are willing to compromise it in some way in order to make it more suitable to the way they would rather do things?
Not satisfactory.
It's not satisfactory. Notice he did not say, no, nobody can go. He said, I heard what you said, Moses. How about this? How about we let you do some of the people? Does the judgment come anyway?
Yes.
Yeah, see, it's either all God's way or none of God's way. I mean, you're either going to agree with what God says 100% and do it his way, but a compromise doesn't work. A miss is as good as a mile. And so Pharaoh says, let the men go that are among you and serve the Lord, for that is what you desire. So then they were driven out of Pharaoh's presence, and the Lord's reaction was, stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt for the locusts, that they may come up on the land of Egypt and eat every plant of the land, even all that the hail has left. So Moses stretched out his staff over the land of Egypt, and the Lord directed the east wind on the land all that day and all that night. And when it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts. And the locusts came up over all the land of Egypt and settled in all the territory of Egypt, and they were very numerous. And there had never been so many locusts, nor would there be so many ever again. I'm glad to hear that part. For they covered the surface of the whole land, so that the land was darkened. And they ate every plant of the land and all the fruit of the trees that the hail had left. Thus nothing green was left on tree or plant of the field through all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh hurriedly called for Moses and Aaron, and he said, I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you. We heard that last week, didn't we? These foxhole confessions. People who, once they're really in trouble, cry out to God if that'll get them what they want. Is it enough to get a person just to make a profession by convincing them that good things happen for them if they'll just choose God? Because that's certainly what's being taught today, isn't it? Get people to make a decision for Christ by telling them all the good things that'll happen to them. You can have your best life now. You can have health, wealth, prosperity. Everything will go your way if you just choose Jesus now. Isn't that what Pharaoh keeps doing? He keeps saying, I've sinned. I repent. I know that God is God. I mean, doesn't that sound like a profession of faith? Doesn't that sound, if that happened in most churches today, they'd go, another sinner saved. But the real proof of the matter is, are you willing to do God's things God's way? Or are you only willing to profess God when it's beneficial to you? Or are you willing to say that God is God even when it goes bad for you? If you really believe that God is God, then he's just as much God on the mountaintop as he is God in the valley. He's God the whole time. Pharaoh is only interested in God being God when it benefits him. And as soon as it doesn't benefit him anymore, he hates that God and God's people, and he's out there rebelling again. So, then Pharaoh hurriedly called for Moses and Aaron, and he said, I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you. Now, therefore, please forgive my sin only this once and make supplication to the Lord your God that he would only remove this death from me. It's the same thing he said last week. It's the same thing he said last plague. Last plague, did he mean it? No, of course not. He's only interested in what benefits him. So he went out from Pharaoh and he made supplication to the Lord. So the Lord shifted the wind to a very strong west wind, which took up the locusts and drove them into the Red Sea. And not one locust was left in all the territory of Egypt. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the sons of Israel go. So was his profession of any value?
Nope.
No. So can people make empty professions?
They do.
So once again, as with all the preceding plagues, the gods of Egypt are noticeably silent. You have to wonder what their worshipers thought as they saw the devastation that was brought about by these locusts. Where was Nepri, who was the god of the grain, who protected the harvest? Where was he at this point? Where was Ermatut, who was the goddess of childbirth and crops? Wouldn't that god have helped if she had any power at all? Wouldn't you expect that god to be there to help the people that worshipped? No, not there, nothing. Isis, the god of the earth, once again, completely silent. Thermuthis is the goddess of fertility and the goddess of the harvest, and we heard nothing from her. And Seth, another god of the crops, completely mute. Nothing from any of the Egyptian gods. What does that prove about them? They're not there. They don't exist. And that's why God has this long history of mocking other gods, like he did with Elijah, when Elijah got all the priests of Baal together and mocked them because their God wouldn't answer them. And he said, we'll set up a test. You offer an offering, I'll offer an offering. Let's see which God responds. And their God did not respond at all. And he ended up mocking them and saying, well, maybe he's busy. Maybe he's inconvenienced. Maybe this is not a good time for him. Yell louder. And they cut themselves and they shouted out to their God from morning till night and they got nothing from him. God has a long history of doing this. God puts the other gods, the man-made gods, the human gods, on display and make sure that human beings understand that those gods are powerless. They can't do anything. They can't help you. And yet people love to set up their gods and worship them because they control those gods. So those gods appeal to their ego and those gods are like them. And so that's another form of self-worship. But the God of heaven mocks those gods. You had your hand up. Yes, ma'am.
I know that this wouldn't take very long for all of these locusts to eat every single thing in sight, but I mean, is there any kind of supporting evidence that would say how long this lasted? Because if you think about all the things that have been happening before this, I mean, there's got to be absolutely pretty much nothing left of Egypt. And I'm wondering, what were these people eating, you know? Because there was absolutely nothing.
But remember that months are passing. Remember that the hail stuff probably came by virtue of the particular crops that we hear the hail destroyed. Uh-huh. That was happening January, that period of time. And this is happening more like March, April. Uh-huh. Months have passed. Things have time to grow again. Uh-huh. And so I would think that the beginning of that new growth would be giving the Egyptians hope. You know,
and he crushes it again.
And he crushes it again, yeah. Like, oh yeah, you're hungry, here comes some food. No!
No.
Yeah, so.
By locusts?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Anyone? Yeah.
Exactly. So. But in terms of how long the locusts are there, we're not told. They are there sufficiently long to destroy everything that's left over.
It wouldn't take very long if it was.
No, it wouldn't take
devastatingly
long.
Devastatingly. Yeah.
Also, you're talking about, when you're talking about all the land of Egypt, you're talking about a large landmass, too. Mm-hmm. And so you're talking about a lot of locusts that could come in and wipe out everything.
Well, the sky was black, you know.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And if, by the way, this is that period of time that I just described, March, April, we know that it is mid-April, basically, that the Exodus happens. And so after he's destroyed all the food stuff and brought about, you know, these plagues and brought about famine in Egypt, right behind that, he takes his people out. Always, always, his people have an escape. Anything else? All right, good.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.